ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by the Hagen Oaks Golf Super Shop, America's most awarded golf facility. Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
Hello, everyone. Welcome into the Golf to Go Radio Hour right here on Sactown Sports 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa. My buddy Scott Marsh is here. And it's Masters Week, Scott. It's golfers' Valhalla. I mean, everybody is always really excited this time of year. The sun begins to shine, the birds begin to sing, the grass grows, and it's Masters Week.
Yeah, it makes you feel like spring is here, although it's tough for us to feel that way in Sacramento at the moment, but couldn't be any more excited about the tournament.
Yeah, it's trying to get warmer. Because of the tournament, we've got a couple of guests today that are accomplished experts in knowing about that particular tournament. First on the show is Robert T. Jones the Fourth, better known as the grandson of Bobby Jones, the founder of Augusta National and the Masters Tournament. And Bob's been on the show before, and he was happy to come by again, and I sure appreciate it. We're going to talk about his reminiscences of not only his grandfather, but about the tournament over the years, his career, what it's like to walk the property, and a surprising conversation that he had with his grandfather after the first time that that Bob Jones the Fourth actually visited the Masters.
I can't wait to hear that. I know you did this interview. It's going to be special. And you know, the thing about the Masters, which makes it unbelievable, is there's just no other tournament in the world that has the history of this event. And to have Robert Jones on to listen to the history firsthand is going to be a real treat.
Yeah, he's a good storyteller as well. And speaking of storytellers, Jim Fitzpatrick, a nationally recognized golf artist from right here in Little River City, Sacramento, will talk about his thoughts on the Masters and his experiences there as well, and kind of relate some of his artwork to some of the players of the Masters.
I think it's fair to say he's had some of the most influential artwork that the Masters has ever created in terms of some of the winners that he's portrayed, and it's going to be awesome to talk to him.
Absolutely. So we're not going to talk about our golf this week because nobody cares about our golf. We want to know. There's a lot we want to know. I mean, with rain forecast, with the LIV golfers being invited to play with the PGA Tour players this year, it's there's a lot of interesting underlying currents and stories about this year's Masters in particular.
There is, and I think that's why it makes it so great that the Masters is right now, because if there's anything that represents class civility in the golf world, it's the Masters, and maybe we'll have some harmony here at least for a week.
Absolutely right. I that's very well said. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. We are going to do a little bit of business here, and we'll be back with Robert T. Jones the Fourth right after these messages.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
Golf to Go Radio Hour continues right here on Sactown Sports 1140. I'm really excited to welcome our next guest. Robert T. Jones the Fourth is a licensed psychologist at the Behavioral Institute of Atlanta. Dr. Jones is a nationally recognized sports psychologist and has appeared on many major sports outlets, including the Golf Channel, ESPN, and NBC Sports. He's also the grandson of golf icon Robert T. Jones Jr., better known as Bobby Jones, who, of course, is the founder of the Augusta National Golf Club and the Masters Tournament. And maybe most importantly to me, he's a great friend of the Golf to Go radio show. Hey, Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great, Frank. It's great to be with you today.
I certainly appreciate you taking the time. This is a pretty exciting week for golfers. Masters Week is we rejoice. We see the green grass, the azaleas, the greatest players in the world, and it's the unofficial kickoff to the golf season for many of us. What does Masters Week mean to you, Bob?
You know, I think it means quite a bit the same as it does to any golfer, in the sense that it really does sort of symbolize the beginning of the golf season. It certainly does that for those that live north of the Mason-Dixon line, where many of them are still quite cold. But to me, it means even more, because the Masters is always a time in which my family and I, at least in some way reconnect with our late grandfather. And it's really hard not to do that when you're on the grounds of Augusta National. Although so much has changed from when he passed away in December of 1971, you can still tell underneath all of the change, you can still see that constant that is that absolutely magnificent golf course that could only have emerged from the mind of golf's greatest, or at least one of its greatest champions, who also happens to be a very dear man to me.
I'm certain he was and remains, when did you finally realize as his grandson, and I think you called him Bubs, as I remember.
Bub, yes.
That your grandfather was this icon in the world. I mean, was that a transition that was easy for you to understand as a young boy?
No, quite the contrary. I remember, you know, he was an invalid for all my life. He suffered from a terrible spinal disease called syringomyelia, which is very hard to pronounce and very hard to watch. But as a result, he was paralyzed from the neck down for the bulk of my life, and I watched that progress. And in my mind, there was almost like two Bobby Joneses. There was the very elegant, dashing 28-year-old who wore those really neat clothes and had that silky smooth golf swing. And then there was Bub, who was my grandfather, who was in a wheelchair and incapacitated. And I remember the first time I actually went to the Masters, it was in 1970. And I got there late at night. My father couldn't meet me at the airport. He was in a rules committee meeting. So he had a driver from the club come and pick me up. And by the time I got to the club, it was late at night, like I was 12 years old. It was like 9:30 at night, pitch black dark. And I remember I went to sleep in the Jones cabin. And I woke up the next morning. This would have been a Sunday morning. I woke up at about 6:15. I've always been an early riser. Nowadays, I'd call 6:15 oversleeping, but it was early back then. And I remember I walked out into the living room and then went out the door onto the back patio, which overlooked the 10th tee. And the sun was coming up, the mowers were going, you know, off to my right, I could see the clubhouse and I could hear kind of like the clanking of the silverware as the tables were being set. And I had this vista from the clubhouse all the way down, looking across the golf course. And all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks that everything that I was seeing there had existed in my grandfather's mind before a shovel full of dirt had ever been turned over on the property. And I remember so vividly and so clearly that was the first time that I had ever encountered the absolute power of Bobby Jones. And the fact that this was my grandfather, it was just mind-boggling to me. He was not at that Masters. That was the first or the second year that he'd not been able to attend. And I remember the next week, I called him and he said, "Well, son, I hear you went to see the Masters." I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, what did you think of it?" And I said, "Bub, I thought it was the most incredible thing I've ever seen." And he got quiet for a moment and he said, "Well, that's just fine." And then he changed the subject to something totally different. And, you know, and it's funny, it wasn't until a number of years later, like a few years ago, that I told my wife that story. And she said, "Well, I can see why he would be that way." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "He just changed the subject." I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "I can understand why he would feel that way." She said, "You know, he probably had always hoped that would have been an experience that he would have been able to share with his grandson. And that probably he was sad that just wasn't in the cards for you or him." And I'd never really thought about that before, but it certainly does make a certain amount of sense. But even so, that memory of that. I mean, to be honest, I can close my eyes right now, and I'm almost 66 years old, and I can close my eyes right now and still see Augusta National as I saw it on that sunny Sunday morning in 1970. Stuck, we just burned in there.
Bob, you give me chills when you talk about your grandfather. I so enjoy talking to you. You know, everybody recognizes the name Bobby Jones, and most people know somehow he's associated with golf. But for those that may have kind of, you know, gotten to the party late, why don't you give me just kind of the brief background? I don't know how you make his life a brief, but give me kind of the highlights of how Bobby Jones and his stature in the world of golf and in the world in general just kind of came to be.
Well, probably he is probably best known as a golfer for going on one of the most dominant streaks that the game has ever seen, and probably did not see again until Tiger Woods came along. He was from Atlanta, played in his first national tournament, the United States Amateur, when he was 14 years old. And he struggled for a number of years until finally breaking through and winning the United States Open in 1923. And between 1923 and 1930, he set a record that some of which his records still stand. He won 13 major championships between 1923 and 1930. That stood until 1972 when Jack Nicklaus won the United States Open at Pebble Beach. But he became the first man in history to win the double, which is both Open championships in the same year, and that's the British and United States Opens. And then in 1930, he did the unthinkable, and that was he won all four major championships in the same year for what we now know as the Grand Slam. Of course, it took several weeks to figure out what to call it because nobody had ever done that before.
Yeah.
And then after that, he retired from competitive golf, although golf would always remain a part of his life. He designed Augusta National Golf Club, co-founded the Masters Tournament, designed Peachtree Golf Club in Atlanta, was a prodigious golf writer, and created instructional videos that are still state of the art. All the while he was doing that, he was earning a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Georgia Tech, another bachelor's in English literature from Harvard, and attending Emory University School of Law for a year and a half before he passed the bar on a dare and didn't have to finish law school. And while he was doing all that, he married his childhood sweetheart and had three children and obviously grandchildren. But, you know, the thing for all of that, and those are remarkable, remarkable events, and I've just scratched the surface. I didn't even mention the two ticker tape parades he had in New York. Or the fact that he became the first man since Benjamin Franklin to be named an honorary freeman of the Burg of St. Andrews in Scotland. But the thing that I think was the most amazing thing, Frank, was that, you know, he was diagnosed with this horrible condition, syringomyelia, which just devastated him physically. But he never lost his spirit and his compassion. And it led the late sports writer Herb Wynn to make what I think is the best comment about my grandfather. And he said, in the early years, he stood up with grace and dignity to just about the best that life has to offer, which is not easy. And then later in life, he stood up with equal grace and dignity to just about the worst. And I think that's really correct. And to be honest, I have often believed that if Bobby Jones had not dealt with illness as elegantly as he did, and it was still difficult, but he dealt with it, as Wind said, with grace and dignity, I don't know that we would be talking about him today. I think it is the triumph on the golf course that led to the triumph in the face of illness. And I think those combined to make him, to a certain extent, and I'm sorry that this is the case, but it does make him a little bit larger than life.
And those are the people we really get excited hearing stories about. I have so many more questions about the Masters, but as long as we kind of broke the surface about some of his accomplishments, this summer is the 100th anniversary of his first United States Open Championship. And that, what an accomplishment that is. And you're planning a little centennial about that as well.
We are starting it. Yes, we're starting a centennial celebration. It is, as a family, we are. It is what it is going to do is it's going to, we, our plan is it will start this summer, and our intention is to culminate in 2030 for the 100th anniversary of the Grand Slam. This will be a commercial venture of the Jones family. Basically, it's going to be a name, image, likeness kind of sponsorship arrangement. But part of the reason we're doing this is to increase the awareness of what it is that he has done. But second, we want to be able to make a substantial contribution to a foundation that is dedicated to finding the cure for the disease that claimed his life. If people are interested in learning more, they can go to our website, which is bobbyjones.org. And they can find there a tab on the centennial and learn more about what we do as a family, and also learn a little bit about what our plans are for the coming for the next 8 years.
My hat's off to you. Wish you every success as you undertake that venture. We are talking to Robert T. Jones IV, grandson of Bobby Jones, and we have to pay some bills, so we're going to take a short break and be right back with Bob right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
Welcome back into the Golf to Go Radio Hour right here on Sactown Sports 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa, and my guest today is Mr. Robert T. Jones IV, and he is the grandson of the legendary Bobby Jones. And this being Masters Week, I thought it fun to have Bob back on the show. It's always a pleasure to have you, Bob. And you know, with Masters Week, everybody gets really excited, as we kind of talked about. And I just can't imagine what it's like around Augusta this week. And so give us kind of a peek for those of us that haven't had a chance to be there. When you walk on the grounds tomorrow, what's it going to be like?
Well, every year when I get to, I'm one of the few that gets the privilege to drive down Magnolia Lane every year. And I would like to say that, you know, after all these years driving down Magnolia Lane, it really doesn't do much for me anymore. But that would be like saying, yes, you know, I've just had another routine day going to St. Peter's. There is no way that you can turn off Washington Road to go down Magnolia Lane, where even all this many years, it does not take my breath away. It just absolutely does. Every single time, and especially early on in the tournament, because, you know, this is as close as golf gets to an opening day like you have in baseball. You know, they say that in baseball, opening day is absolutely fantastic because every team is undefeated. Mm. And so there is hope for everybody, ranging from, you know, the Braves all the way to the Cubs. Everybody, it's all new. And when you go to the Masters, first of all, the beauty of it just bowls you over. And then everybody's got a favorite player, somebody that they really, and players they really, really want to see do well. And some of them will do well, and some of them might not even be there on Saturday. But on that day, on Thursday, it's the anticipation is just overwhelming. And then, you know, you get out of your car and you find your way out to the golf course, and there's that golf course. It's green, the flowers are beautiful, the azaleas are beautiful, and then you'll start hearing, if you're there late enough, you hear like these polite rounds of applause coming from over by the first tee or the 10th tee, and then the day will progress, and all of a sudden you start hearing the roars. And it's very funny. When you've been to the Masters for a while, you can get to a point where you can hear a roar when you're on top of the hill, And if you know the place well enough, you will recognize immediately where it came from. And so, you know, you always pull out your grouping sheet, you'll take a look and you'll see who is where, and then you can pretty well anticipate what it was you just heard. And then you wait until you see those scoreboards just kind of open up by a player's name, and you know you're about to see something. And then they put it up and there's that red number to say that they've just had a birdie or an eagle. There's no experience quite like that. And I mean, in a day now, like we are now, of instant gratification, you know, where cellular technology brings everything to you immediately, there's nothing like that experience at the Masters of hearing the roar and waiting for the scoreboard. It's really, there is nothing in sports like that.
And over the years, certainly there have been so many of those moments that that have become iconic in themselves. You know,
oh my gosh,
Nicklaus and Tiger's chip at 16, was it? And they kind of burn in people's minds. I mean, we can see them. We can almost feel them again. And they're just, you know, they're just kind of chilling moments.
And yet one of the most pivotal of all of them is one that very, very few people saw. And that happened in 1935 when Gene Sarazen got on the, was out there on the golf course. And I believe can't remember if it was 13 or 15. I wasn't there. It was 1935. But he knocked his second shot into the hole for a double eagle and went on to win the tournament. And, you know, Sarazen said to his dying day, he said there were maybe 20 people out there to see the shot. And he said, but by the time he died, all the people that said they had been there to see the shot had to have been thousands. And they were all convinced that they had. I mean, that's just how you can see something or hear of something and it becomes alive in your mind. And no place does that like Augusta. I remember the last time I watched Arnold Palmer playing at the Masters. Well, not the last time, but certainly one of the last. I was out with my wife, and Arnie came to the 15th hole, and we were standing up around the landing area 15, and Palmer hit it about 40 yards short of where that landing area was because he was getting older. And he got up to the top of the hill, and I'll never forget it. He was standing, I'm guessing he was about 215, 220 from the hole, and you could see his mind working. And there were maybe 300 people watching him. And all of a sudden, you could see he was toying with the head cover of his fairway wood. And to every single person that was there, me included, all of a sudden, we just got so excited because all of a sudden, here it was. It was 1960 all over again. Yeah. And Arnie's going to go for the green. And he pulled out that the fairway wood. I'm assuming he hit a three wood. And the ball landed on the front of the green, released toward the hole, finally did run over the back. And I think he three putted for a par. Wow. But you know, for that one instant, Arnie's army was very, very much alive. And it connected us back to all that time from 1958, 1960, 1962, 1964, when Arnie won the Masters. In fact, you know, it got to the point with him where they said after those four wins, 58, 60, 62, and 64, Frank, I don't know if you knew this, they finally got to the point where they said that Arnold Palmer could only win the Masters in even numbered years.
Yeah.
And where else do you get experiences like that but Augusta National?
You know, listening to you talk, it kind of brings up the thought, do the players make the Masters, or do the Masters make the players? I mean, it's quite a stage. And you really have to kind of step to the front if you're going to be on that stage. Certainly they work in conjunction, but it's an interesting thought to wonder, you know, which makes the other, I guess.
Well, I think you hit it. I think the answer to the question is yes, but this is the hallmark, I think, of major championship golf. for the most part, I mean, it's safe to say that there are times when people will win a major championship that you don't exactly think of as being like major champion material. But for the most part, what really sets major championships apart is their ability to call forward this wonderful performance from the best players in the game. I think, you know, we've seen that time and again, certainly in every major championship, but I don't think any more so than you do in the Masters. Augusta National has this really unique ability to call forward excellence. And Lord knows we got a lot of players who are capable of delivering it.
There's a lot of people that wear green jackets in addition to the winners. How did the green jackets come about?
Well, they actually started out. As a way that the members could be set apart. So, for example, if you were visiting the property and you needed advice on where do I go to find whatever, you could just go to somebody that was wearing a green jacket and they would be able to tell you. So originally, it was simply as a member, as a way of identifying who the members were. And it was supposed to be, it was originally intended as something to increase the hospitality of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, it got to the point to where the Masters, the winner of the Masters was granted a green jacket also. And so it kind of extended over time, but that's how it started.
And there's some incredible traditions, not the least of which is the Champions Dinner. If I understand the story correctly, was it not Ben Hogan that did the first one?
Yes, he did. He certainly did. I think it was like 1947, I think. He had sent a letter to Cliff Roberts and basically said that he would like to start a dinner for all the past Masters champions. And he said, and I would be also honored if you and Bob Jones would attend. And my grandfather used to love to go to those. He would also go every year to the Amateurs dinner, which I believe is on Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
And he always enjoyed that. Of course, you know, back then, there were far more amateurs in the game because it was not a given that just because you were an outstanding amateur that you would be turning professional. And in fact, the current chairman of the Masters, Fred Ridley, he's the last United States amateur who has not turned professional.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think he won it in like 1975, I think.
Yeah.
So.
And your grandfather never turned professional either.
Never did.
Yeah.
He never did. Now, granted, he surrendered his amateur status after he retired from competitive golf because he wanted to make the instructional videos. He wanted to manufacture equipment through Spalding. Mm-hmm. But he never considered himself a professional. And the USGA basically gave him the honorary title of non-amateur. Finally, at one year, Joe Dye, who is the head of the USGA, wrote him and said, Bob, I really think it's time you reapply to have your amateur status reinstated. And so they sent him the application form and my grandfather wrote on it. And they said, what's your name? And he wrote his name. And what's your address? And he wrote that. And they said, who's your employer? And he put down Clifford Roberts. And then it said, do you plan on playing according to the standards of integrity set out by the rules of amateur status? To which my grandfather wrote something like, only if somebody is watching. And then he said, do you have any reservation? Are you doing this with any reservations? And he wrote, I have no reservations about anything. And sent it back to Joe Dye.
What do you think if Bobby Jones were to walk to the first tee today and see what whether you would say improved or at least changed about his course, what do you think his reaction would be? And what do you think his reaction would be about how iconic the whole tournament has become?
I want to be careful how I answer this because I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not sure that if my grandfather were just to miraculously show up on the property today, that he would recognize either the Masters Tournament or the Augusta National Golf Club. I'm not saying he wouldn't recognize the clubhouse or the property.
Sure.
But I don't know that he would recognize what either of them has become. But I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. The club, I remember he died this year, it will be 52 years ago. Wow. 52 years ago. And so a lot has changed in that time. There has been a commercialization of Augusta National that he probably would not be pleased to see, but it's kind of a necessity in the world in which we live now.
Sure.
He might have trouble recognizing a golf course that is playing as long as Augusta is, and the fine manicuring that you see to the course that was not there when he was around. But I think there are some things that he would be very pleased with. I think the club's efforts to keep the course playable to what he originally thought about. For example, I think the lengthening of number five keeps the shot values of five pretty much where they were originally planned. The lengthening of 13 and of seven. Those were never intended. 13 was never intended by my grandfather to be a hole where you could just blow it over the trees on the left and hit a wedge.
Sure.
It was supposed to be a place of momentous decision-making where you really had to debate whether you were going to risk going for the green or not. I think there are some things that he would particularly be pleased with. Like, I think he would be pleased that the patrons of the Masters tournaments are still some of the most educated and mannerly of any spectators in sport. I think he would be really pleased with that. Would he be pleased with an 80,000 square foot merchandise center? Probably not. But in 1971, would that have occurred to anybody?
Sure. Yeah.
I think they've managed it. I think they've managed it about as well as it can be. And they have created a living, breathing icon.
No question. I think one thing I would know for certain is I think that Bobby Jones would have been very proud of his grandson and how you've continued to tell the world his story and be kind of a teacher for those of us that have maybe missed some of the nuances of his life and of the tournament. And you know, you do this while you continue to work as a clinical psychologist. And as we were talking earlier, you love your work. You love being able to talk to folks. And, you know, that certainly comes across whenever you and I have a chance to talk. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate everything you've always meant to me, Bob, and how much you've meant to the show.
Thank you, Frank. I really appreciate that. That means a lot. Thank you.
Well, you know, it has much to say about the people we meet in the world of golf as well. And someday, we've talked about it before, someday we will tee it up on a golf course somewhere, I'm sure.
I'd love it. I would love it.
Robert T. Jones IV, the grandson of the iconic Bobby Jones and an icon in his own way as well. Thanks so much for being with us on the Golf to Go Radio Hour. Masters Week. Enjoy it. We'll be back with more right after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa on Sactown Sports.
Welcome into the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports 1140. Hello, everyone. I'm Frank LaRosa along with Scott Marsh. And we're going to welcome in Mr. Jim Fitzpatrick. Jim is a nationally recognized, maybe internationally recognized golf artist. And Jim, before I introduce you, it was occurring to me that you know, most cities have poet laureates, and I'm not sure why, you know, Sacramento doesn't have a golf artist laureate, but I think if we did, you know, it probably would be you. So welcome, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's so nice of you to invite me. This is exciting.
It's always fun to have you on the show. You know, when I think about the times we've spent together, all I remember is the stories that you tell. And You know, they certainly are rich with history and fun and people, and it's been a joy to know you over the years. Jim, how did you get into golf? I mean, you've been a follower, a lover, a player of the game for most of your life. When did the bug get you?
Well, when I was a kid, my family belonged to Sierra View out in Roseville, and my dad played golf, but he didn't really, I didn't go play with him, but, you know, he told me, in fact, the golf course that's owned by Jeff, you know, our local golf pro, his son is playing in the Masters.
Jeff Chan.
Yeah. So the course that those guys own now, my dad told me, if I go out there and practice and play, if I break, I think I had to break 40 before I got to play at Sierra View.
And, so you, then and obviously I got to, you did.
I did. And I just love the game. You know, and I played a lot at Sierra View when I was a kid. And I played a lot with older guys because there wasn't a lot of kids playing then. And I just learned, you know, it's like the first tee. They have the eight things that you're supposed to learn about people, and they stress those, and I really think that golf teaches them. You don't even have to, you know, you learn to be polite, you learn to say what you're supposed to say, and you don't cheat and you don't lie, and it's all involved in playing golf.
Yeah, the game certainly does have a lot to teach.
Oh, it does.
You know, my guess is that you know, the your love, I think Arnold Palmer says when you fall in love with golf, you fall hard. And I'm thinking that probably was the same with you.
Oh, yeah. I when I was a kid, I actually lettered in four sports in 1 year, which is not easy to do. But I was a pretty good player in all the sports. But then when golf came along, I dropped out of football and I dropped out of track and field, and I just played basketball and golf because I could do that together. And then finally, I think by my junior year, I stopped playing basketball and just did nothing but golf.
And we are all the beneficiaries of that. If you don't have a Fitzpatrick hanging on your wall, I'm sure one of your friends does. You know, this is a really special time of the year. I kind of refer to it as the unofficial kickoff to the golf season when Masters Week comes along.
Absolutely.
What are your earliest memories of the Masters?
Boy, you know, I'm sure it was from television and watching, you know, on TV, and just probably the beauty of the golf course is my earliest memory. It's so special, and the players and Bobby Jones and the stories and the history about, you know, I mean, that's the fun part, is the guy wins the Grand Slam. And today a lot of people don't even know what the Grand Slam is, but he actually, in 1930, he won the British Open, the U.S. Open, the British Amateur, and the U.S. Amateur. That was the Grand Slam. And I don't think anybody will ever do that again.
He was,
so when he got done, he basically retired from golf. And then the golf writer asked him the question, well, what are you going to do now? And that's his answer was, I'm going to build a golf course. And that was Augusta National.
And that building that course certainly has a lot of stories associated with that as well. You know, you've had the opportunity over the years to be with so many of golf's greatest, and then you know, having the opportunity to paint them and to interview them and so forth. When you see them on television, especially in a tournament like the Masters, how do you separate the friendship from rooting for someone to win, or can you?
I don't think you can. And I do like, again, I tend to revert back so many times when I say things to Bobby Jones. But, you know, as time went on, he made this great, the greatest statement, I think, of all. And he said, you know, I don't care how far today's modern players hit the ball. Still, the most important yardage of the game is just 4 inches. And that's, you know, the space between your ears. And I think that that has been interpreted in a lot of different ways. Most people just think of it as attitude. But I really think that what he was talking about was course management. And they designed that course specifically to require a lot of course management to play it.
What do you think is the toughest part of that course?
Well, the toughest part of the course is the fact that there's smaller greens. And this is one of the things everybody that ever goes back there, always their first impression was, wow, I didn't realize how undulating the greens were. Because, you know, the telecast is at the top of the day, the sun's high, and you really can't see them. But when you get there and you see how incredible the undulations are, and what that requires is that you must know the pin placement before you hit your tee ball. And because of the firmness of the surround and the green itself, you have to be able to hit your drive in exactly the right place, or that you can't get the ball close to the hole. And I tell people that, I say, you hit the ball in the wrong place off the tee and you're going to three putt. And they go, what are you talking about? And I said, well, because you can't get the ball to stop below the hole from certain angles. And the greens are so hard and firm, you have to figure out how to keep that ball below the hole.
I think it's amazing to listen to accomplished players who talk about playing the course backwards, which basically, as you say, is putting your tee shot where it is to give you an opportunity to hit that second shot. And most of us, you know, recreational weekend golfers are just trying to keep the tee ball anywhere in the middle of the fairway. And, you know, we feel we've accomplished something at that point. Scott, as someone that was at the Masters, was it last year, I guess, you got to be chomping at the bit to watch it this year.
I can't wait. And yes, Jim, to the point, the first thing I did when I walked on the course, besides thinking I had landed in golf heaven, was I can't believe how undulating the greens are. It's just the course. It's the toughest walk in golf. And, you know, when Tiger Woods is trying to compete there, you can see what the challenge is for him just to walk the course, given his condition. You know, it's so magnificent. Jim, what I'm wondering, two things. One, you talk about the course management. Obviously, Augusta National is trying to fix that with moving back the 13th hole, the driving distance, 35 yards. Your thoughts on that? And then two, I'm just wondering, what's your favorite Masters golf portrait that you've done or you've seen?
Oh, gosh. You know, you almost are glued to the 13th hole, and it's because of all the azaleas back behind the green. And that place, a lot of people know, but before it was a golf course, it was a nursery, and they grew the azaleas were there before the golf course was. And of course they've added some, but those things are 12 to 15 feet high in areas. They're just amazing. And it kind of distorts the average person's view because it makes the bunkers and everything look a lot smaller than they actually are, because you don't imagine plants being that big. But when they have the full bloom, that 13th hole with the gorgeous bunkering, a little creek, raised creek in front of the green, and the undulations and then the pines behind, there isn't anything more beautiful, I don't think, than that.
He wants to know your favorite Masters portrait.
My picture, you know, for other reasons, I also like, I call it Amen Corner, but on 11, I painted Nick Faldo walking up 11, because we happened to be there the year he won his second Masters. And I'm sure all the stories are out there right now in the news, but, you know, Arnold, he made that thing so important because of his charisma, and he won the thing in 58, 60, 62, and 64, all even years. And he was in contention in between, and they kind of said, you know, this tournament is jinxed. Nobody can win back to back. And then Nicholas, he won it in 65, 66, but just outright wins. And that broke the jinx. But the next time anybody won two in a row wasn't until Nick Faldo in 89 and 90. And his were both in playoffs that both ended on 11. So that hole is so special to him. And we happened to be there when he won his second one, and we were in the Butler cabin, and he walks in with Charlie Yates, who was our host, the Secretary of Augusta. And I had just done a portrait of him, and he showed it to Nick, and he says, oh, that's cool. I know who Jim is. And so then he said, Jim, I might need a painting. And I said, well, I've been thinking about it all afternoon, and I'd love to do one of you on 11. And I'll make you a special deal if you sign a whole bunch of them, which he ended up doing. But that's the hole we picked to do because of the meaning for Nick. I mean, it's just incredible. Not to mention, it's a tough hole. Yeah, 11 is, you've really got to hit a good drive in the right place. And if you hit the ball, in fact, Hogan always said, if you ever see me on the green in two, I've missed my shot, because it's so firm and treacherously sloping towards Ray's Creek that Hogan used to play just to the right of the green. And again, there's your course management.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you want us to think around the golf course. I'm just trying to get through 18 holes. You know, Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. And I know that Scott and I certainly are going to be glued to our televisions this week, and certainly this weekend as well. And I'm guessing you will, too.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we'll have some people out here. Anybody listening, if they're more than welcome to come by the gallery. Carrie makes this great Masters, we call it Masters cheese dip, but it's from a recipe that they gave us that they use when they make the cheese sandwiches.
Oh, wow.
They're called pimento sandwiches, and they're really good. And she makes more than enough, and it's always gone because everybody just loves it.
Jim, give us the address of the gallery, the Jim Fitzpatrick Art Gallery.
4208. It's 4208 Douglas Boulevard, Suite 200. And we're in Granite Bay.
Not only does Carrie make cheese dip, she also lets you know the address of the place you work. I think that's great. Well, Scott, talk about the Masters. I don't know what else we can add. We've had these two experts, and I think it's now just let's watch the tournament, see what happens, and Sunday afternoon, put our feet up and think we had a good week.
Yeah, they say the Masters doesn't start till you get to the back nine on Sunday. But for me, it just started in the last hour.
This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour. Back next week with more. We appreciate you spending some time with us.